Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome back to Circles of Change, and many of you who followed our show, we're coming up in the launch here and now, our seventh season, know that it started in a period of time when I was really aggravated by the negative preponderance of the media and decided to launch a show all about positivity, and particularly in the fit of change. It's really a pleasure for me then to include our following guest, because she's taken that also, the nanner negativism about advertising and the influence in society, to enlighten us and give us the history of the Ad Council, powerful messages that have done wonderful things in our society here in our country and beyond. So I welcome on the show Wendy Melillo. How are you this morning, Wendy?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. Let me introduce you, Wendy. She was a staff writer for the Washington Post, earning a Pulitzer Prize nomination, an award presented by President Clinton from the White House Correspondents Association for her coverage of the 1992 United Way scandal. Why, at the Washington Post, she won the Penny Missouri Newspaper Award for reporting on behalf of health and nutrition. And for nearly a decade now, Wendy was the Washington, D.C. bureau chief and senior writer for Adweek, where she covered product and political advertising, marketing, PR, and regulation. She is currently an assistant professor at the School of Public Communication at American University. So needless to say, very well equipped to bring us now the history of the Ad Council and really share perspectives on social and behavior change here in our country as a result of their iconic campaigns. You know, Wendy, I think many people know the outcome of the council, but not necessarily the council itself. I mean, when I was reading your book, realizing that Smokey the Bear has been around since 1944, I had no idea.
Yeah, one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book is because everyone is familiar with the campaigns themselves, you know, from Smokey to McGruff to the Crying Indian. But very few people, I think, realize the history of the organization that brought us all of this. And the Ad Council is a nonprofit organization based in New York City. And its birth back in 1942 was fascinating because this was the advertising industry's response to the threat of federal regulation.
Exactly.
In the late 1930s, consumer advertising groups were arguing, look, advertising is bringing us goods and services that we don't need, or it's inflating or puffing up, if you will, the attributes of a product. And consumer groups were quite concerned about this and petitioned the federal government for regulation. And the advertising industry, very smartly, in the book I call it a brilliant public relations move, said we have to do something. And one of the things they did is they organized and said we are going to create a council, and we are going to bring this powerful medium to the federal government to use for communication purposes during a time of war, because you have to remember we're into World War II at that point. And it worked beautifully.
Yes, and in fact, of course, there's probably the absolutely iconic poster and campaign is Rosie the Riveter. And go get, you know, just get it done.
Rosie was such a surprise to me. I have to say, quite honestly, I thought I knew a lot of this material. But when I actually dug into the research, I discovered that the Ad Council had been using that famous We Can Do It poster. Mm-hmm. And your listeners may recall that's the iconic image of Rosie with her polka dot bandana. Mm-hmm. She's flexing her muscle. And the slogan is, We Can Do It. Well, this was not a poster that was actually done by the Ad Council or its ad agency at the time, J. Walter Thompson, now JWT in New York City. It was done by a freelance Pittsburgh artist, and it only hung inside the Westinghouse factory for a couple of weeks.
Oh, my word, yeah.
And so this created a whole new story that I had to tell. Not only did I had to to tell the story of the Ad Council's very effective and powerful Woman Power campaign, which it did on behalf of the War Manpower Commission during World War II. And this was to get women into, you know, the workforce so that they could take the jobs that were once held by men who were off fighting the war to keep the economic engine of the war going for the country. But this poster did not lure all of these women into the workforce, and it wasn't an Ad Council poster. And I was just amazed at the history of that.
Well, and I think, again, you're being a professor in the School of Public Communication, we always know that kind of history can get rewritten. Right? Or
absolutely.
It can come at us from a variety of directions. And I think that's also where people just get naturally suspicious of, quote, the media. But I think, again, the power of your book is to make us take pause and appreciate that essentially the Ad Council, whether or not they got dragged into it or chose to go there to prevent regulation, but at the same time have adopted a very strong philanthropic focus, which I can't imagine what it looks like in those Ad Council meetings and the process to decide where to deploy the funds with potential private interests involved and, you know, political divide to cross and so on, to say, well, why not my cause versus her cause, et cetera.
Well, I think it's important for people to understand first that one of my goals with this book is to make people more media literate.
Yes.
You can't just accept the messages that are coming at you at face value. And don't get me wrong, the Ad Council has done a lot of good work in this country. But there's also another side where the Ad Council is influenced by corporate interests. Mm-hmm. It is influenced by federal government interests. And I think that people who view these public service ads need to be aware of those influences. And in the meetings that you discuss, I did have the opportunity to attend some of those meetings, and you see the influences come through very clearly. The Ad Council has to walk this tightrope.
Very tight.
Because it tries to be as non-controversial as possible. And that's important because if it's too controversial, it will not get its message on network television. Because anything that is too political, too overtly sexual, smacks of advocacy, the television networks just won't air the stuff.
Because they've got paying customers on the other side of the ledger that are going in a different direction.
And they're also going to have listeners and viewers with both radio and television who will complain vociferously, and they do not want complaints. Now, that has an effect on all of us as American citizens, because certain topics that we should be addressing, like climate change, for example, don't get addressed through Ad Council campaigns because it's too controversial a subject.
Right. And isn't a lot of this, too, depending on timing? I mean, you think about, I can recall in my younger days, the amount of videos we saw in health class about not smoking, you know, on and on and on. Yet, it wasn't until smoking became socially unacceptable, really, that knowledge that had been planted flourished and you saw a significant downturn in the number of smokers.
Well, I think it had a lot to do with are discovering through the state lawsuits against big tobacco just how much they knew. And in all that discovery process and the legal process, all of those documents came out that showed that the tobacco industry knew that this product caused cancer and was killing people, yet they hid it. And I think that was a very important change where people felt very duped.
Yeah, that's right.
By big tobacco, which all, you know, led to that. And out of that master settlement agreement that we saw between the 46 states suing, we got the birth of the American Legacy Foundation, which is a separate, you know, public service advertising kind of effort that brought us the Truth Campaign.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
We have these forces of public service advertising that are strong in this country. The Ad Council has not done that much with tobacco. But again, it's one of those very controversial kind of.
Well, Wendy, your background, as I mentioned in the introduction, of course, you spent time here as a bureau chief involved in covering product and political advertising, marketing, PR, regulation, and the like. Of course, you also being a longtime follower and participant in what we mean by media. I mean, we're talking about going from newspaper, print, magazine, to radio, to television, to now the influence of the internet and social media. Tell us how the Ad Council story overlaps all those transition points, if you could briefly.
I think that we need to pay a lot of attention to what has happened with media fragmentation in this country in the wake of the digital revolution. Now think about, you know, the Ad Council spanned decades from 1942 forward. You mentioned Smokey. Smokey started out in 42 as the National Fire Prevention Campaign. The original posters were quite scary and very patriotic. Smokey was not introduced, as you mentioned, until 1944 because they wanted a warm and endearing character. Mm-hmm. But what you're seeing at that time, Smokey was able to go on to become this very memorable giant of a character because most of our media was dominated by three television networks.
Right, right.
And we were all watching. The equivalent that we have today of that are fewer and fewer moments. Mm-hmm. Super Bowl Sunday, mm-hmm. perhaps the Oscars, when you've got upwards of 90 million people watching at one time. So the Ad Council was able to embed that into our cultural zeitgeist, if you will, mm-hmm. where it became, you know, something that we grew up with, we remembered, and even if you didn't grow up with it, you're aware of it because it's out there in our culture. I think that has changed significantly in the digital age, and that's one of the things I worry about when I discuss the future of public service advertising, because we are not all watching the same thing anymore. So it becomes increasingly difficult for the Ad Council and other organizations like it to get those messages across, positive social messages where you're trying to raise awareness and change behavior to solve some of society's more difficult problems. And as a result, they're trying to go where they think everybody is, which is in social media, right? But think about it. If you were to start Smokey Bear today in social media, would he go on to become the giant that he has become?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is no, unfortunately.
Well, and then you also wonder, I wonder who the future giants are and how they're coming about as a result of social media, or even if they are. Because I think your point is so well taken. I mean, you're teaching at the university environment, so your audience day in and day out are a generation, you know, the younger students. I have young children, and to watch the fact that my kids do not watch television, they control their own content when they want on their third, fourth, or fifth screens, as we say, it's a very fragmented scenario. Well, take us back to a couple then of the iconic stories that caught you off guard when you were doing all this research on your book, Wendy, which, by the way, for our listeners who just joined, How McGruff and the Crying Indian Changed America, A History of the Iconic Ad Council. We talked about Smokey the Bear. McGruff. Some people may not remember McGruff, whom are listening, the crime watchdog.
Oh, he's great. He would say in that growly voice, take a bite out of crime.
That's right.
McGruff, we're now in the late 1970s, 1980. And one of the top concerns on the minds of Americans at the time was crime. They wanted to do something about it. However, they didn't want to reach into their pockets and pay more taxpayer dollars to actually put more officers on the street. So the Department of Justice and a nonprofit organization called the National Crime Prevention Council approached the Ad Council about, you know, doing a campaign. And the McGruff character is so interesting. The story about, you know, how McGruff was born. It took place in an airport at 3:00 in the morning, you know, when the advertising man, Jack Kyle, a fascinating character who was working at the ad agency Dancer Fitzgerald Sample at the time, which became our Saatchi & Saatchi today. Mm-hmm. He loved Smokey, and he really wanted an animated kind of character for the McGruff. And he sketched out, you know, some dogs, and this is how we eventually got to McGruff. But McGruff was fascinating because that campaign, we have good social science evidence where this campaign has been studied outside of the Ad Council by academics who really took a look at the effectiveness of it. And McGruff brought us neighborhood watch groups.
Yes.
Think about it. When you go on vacation, you stop your newspaper. Perhaps you leave a light on. You have a neighbor check in on your house. All of that came out of the individual things citizens can do to protect themselves against crime.
That's right. In fact, that as you said, the social science research about, can the Ad Council really inspire individual action for the collective good? That's really what we're getting down to, isn't it? And this campaign clearly showed it could happen.
Yes. And I think that the Ad Council model, based on the individual actions people can take, has its pluses. But I also think there's a real downside to it, because the Ad Council, every campaign is directed toward what we as individual citizens can do. And I think that works very, very well in the case of seatbelts, which was also one of their campaigns. It works very well in the case of McGruff, which we just talked about. It does not work in the case of the crying Indian.
Yeah.
And that was a very interesting campaign for me, like Rosie, to look at. Because the crying Indian, you have another nonprofit organization partnering with the Ad Council. In this case, it's an organization called Keep America Beautiful. I would doubt that your listeners know a lot about Keep America Beautiful. It sounds wonderful as a title, does it not?
Absolutely, yeah. How can you go wrong?
It's, based in Stamford, Connecticut. But this organization is not your grassroots Sierra Club kind of environmental movement group. It's simply not. Keep America Beautiful is the packaged goods manufacturers in this country. It is your Glad plastic baggies for your sandwiches, your Reynolds aluminum for your aluminum foil, your Coca-Cola, your Pepsi-Cola plastic bottles, the American Chemistry Council, the plastics that are in our packaged goods. And the manufacturers create this material. It is sold to the consumer in the packaging of the items that they buy, and it takes a one-way trip into the garbage stream. And when that evocative campaign came out, the Ad Council had been working with Keep America Beautiful since 1960, but it was the 1971 crying Indian that captured everyone's imagination. The advertising industry loved it, that evocative tear coming down the cheek of the Native American. Well, environmental groups cried foul. They just went crazy saying, how dare you put responsibility for litter and pollution in this country on the backs of individuals to clean it up? When look who is sponsoring this campaign. What a fascinating campaign and research. It just opened my eyes to things that, again, I did not know previously.
Well, it also shows you that, again, what the unintended consequences, might we say, or then the whole body of people that will immediately say it was a conspiracy theory and set up to evoke that, right? And so this council and the people that dedicate their time from a nonprofit environment, it takes some pretty strong strength of leadership, let alone the ability to get consensus. It must have been fascinating for you to sit in a room and observe some of the meetings underway.
Oh, yes. They have what is called a kind of a creative review, creative campaign review committee, and that committee is responsible for reviewing the ads that come for a particular topic, and they pull from a roster of 40 to 50 advertising agencies that they have, and they pick an advertising agency based on the particular expertise, so maybe it's Alzheimer's or maybe it's, whatever that they've done work with before. And then that ad agency comes in and presents to a review committee that is comprised of some of the greatest advertising minds in the country who come from advertising agencies, and they sit and they review this stuff. And it is not always a pleasant experience.
Imagine. You're talking about some of the most demanding, aggressive environments. And plus, purposely, the creative world, you get a lot of unexpected. That's just the nature of the beast.
Right. But it goes through a very rigorous review process. And at times, the ad agency preparing the work has to start over from scratch. And so I had the opportunity to actually view some of that, which is never really seen by the public. So that was a wonderful opportunity to get the kind of behind the scenes. How does this organization work? And the way they pick the campaigns as well, equally, they have a roster of people that from, all kinds of organizations that sit on the board that really take a look at this stuff and say, okay, what are our issues going to be?
And actually what you're trying to do is pick the issues that are percolating, not necessarily currently today, because you're trying to strike before the iron even gets there. We're speaking with Wendy Melillo. She's a professor at the American University in Washington, D.C. Her new book is How McGruff and the Crying Indian Changed America, A History of Iconic Ad Council Campaigns. Well, Wendy, as I mentioned in the introduction, of course, this is your space. You're a Pulitzer Prize nominee. You've been involved in investigative reporting over your years. You're a very active member of the media and now teaching those who want to get more involved in the media. Tell me, how did writing this book change you and your own thinking about the profession you followed, and where might you be heading as a result of it?
I think one of the things I learned about being a journalist, because that's what I am by training, is that journalists only scratch the surface at times, where we write a story and then it's quickly on to the next thing. And there's very little follow-up. And as I mentioned with some of the surprises that I found in the book, I thought I knew this stuff because I had covered it for Adweek. But I learned that I didn't really know the stuff, that I had to dig down and go back. I went to 4 university archives for this book, 2 national archives. I pulled the original strategy documents and memos that were written at the time to get the fullest picture possible. Well, that just doesn't happen on deadline when you're a journalist. And what I worry about, you know, when we see the challenges to particularly investigative journalism in this country, where we don't have the time or the resources anymore to do the kind of long-form investigative journalism that we need to shine a light on some things that we would not otherwise know about, I'm very concerned about what that means for our democracy.
Well, it's deeper than that, of course. For those, again, I'll make the reference that in my children's school, they are not allowing the youth to reference Wikipedia as a source when they write their papers. It's all too easy to go to the quick fix, the light brush, the Google search, and like you say, completely miss deeper dives.
Yeah, Wikipedia is a great place to start, I tell my students, but you can't end there.
Well, tell us about the reactions to the book so far, Wendy.
Well, I've been absolutely delighted. I've received, you know, good feedback. I have a web page out there. And
what's the web page so our listeners could participate?
www.howmcgruffchangedamerica.com.
Great.
And people can get more information about the book and me there. I've done a number of radio interviews. I did a nice piece, you know, just commenting as an expert on the topic in the New York Times. So, you know, I'm pleased with what has been happening with this thus far.
Have you gotten any questions that really have made you take pause?
I think that the ones that where people worry about what the future of public service advertising is, where we don't, you know, pay attention to the same things anymore. There's kind of that phrase, we don't know, you know, what we have until it's gone kind of thing. I wonder if that's what's, you know, going to happen now, because public service advertising has changed dramatically. You know, it's considered your bake sales. It's considered, you know, a lot of other things than what's actually being done here. And this stuff is so limited by the very nature of our broadcasting system in this country. You can't really do the cutting edgy stuff because you'll never get it out there. There's too many restrictions.
Although although you are getting it out there, but as you would say, it's probably through the non-traditional forms of the media, which are becoming more and more mainstream in this digital age.
And that's the benefit of the digital age. You can really take advantage of that to get out messages that you could do videos and public service ads that you'd never get on broadcast networks.
Well, your book, of course, How McGruff and the Crying Indian Changed America, talks about the Ad Council. It isn't just these magnificent campaigns about the Crying Indian or Smokey the Bear or Rosie the Riveter, but also slogans. And I love the reminder that some of our slogans, people, again, lose sight of where they came from. For example, the one, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Tell us the story of that.
Oh, that is
amazing.
A fascinating campaign done. The client is the United Negro College Fund at the time. They've shortened their name just to the acronym UNCF. But this campaign was done on behalf of historically black colleges and universities in this country. And in the early 1970s, Vernon Jordan was head of the United Negro College Fund. He is now a lawyer in private practice, and people may remember him as a special advisor to President Bill Clinton. And he fought for this campaign. He went and fought for the better part of a day trying to get the Ad Council to take it. And at first, the Ad Council was resistant, not for really bad reasons, but for two important reasons. In the early 70s, you're coming out of this decade in the 1960s of tumultuous race riots. You've got Brown versus Board of Education on the books, and the buzzword of the land was integration. Mm-hmm. You know, we really need to integrate. So here you are arguing for something that is really a separatist type of thing. You want to, you know, continue historically black colleges and universities rather than integrating, you know, into the universe, all universities in this country. And the second reason the Ad Council was so daunted by this proposal was it's a fundraising campaign at its roots.
Exactly.
And so this was going to raise money on behalf of these colleges and universities. Well, then if it opens the door to this, how does it say no to other worthwhile, you know, causes that want fundraising campaigns through the Ad Council? And it tends to shy away from them. It does do some. There are exceptions to every rule. But really, it looks very seriously at whether or not it wants to do a fundraising campaign. And then the story itself is the advertising copywriter, Forrest Long, who did his research. He went to these, you know, college and universities. He studied it. And he was really influenced by a slogan that the Young and Rubicam, the ad agency that was involved, had done for the Urban Coalition in New York City. That was something like, give time, give jobs, give a damn. That's and right. It was that, you know, ratcheting up that edgier language. And so he walked into his boss's office and he says, I've got the slogan. A mind is a hell of a thing to waste.
And there you go. It started. Well, Wendy, thank you so much. A great insight. The book again, How McGruff and the Crying Indian Changed America, A History of Iconic Ad Council Campaigns. Wendy Melillo, thanks so much for contributing to our show today. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you for having me on.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it. Going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.